Okay. Let's gather again. I think you probably agree with me. That was an absolutely delicious lunch. Well done. Yes. That was fantastic. Okay. So this afternoon, we're going to drill down a little bit more into the scope of practice and the skills and competencies required in refugee health nursing. So when we were thinking about the forum, we thought a good way to attack this was not actually from the bottom up, but actually from the top down. So we've asked Marilyn to come along this afternoon to just do a short case study, a case history, which demonstrates her advanced practice. So we're calling it, what does advanced practice look like in refugee health nursing? So Marilyn obviously is a registered nurse, but also a maternal and child health nurse and an accredited nurse immuniser. She has a broad range of nursing and teaching experience, including community health, district nursing, Aboriginal health, and teaching undergraduate and postgraduate nursing and Aboriginal health workers. She established the Refugee Health Nursing Program at Each in Victoria in 2009, when the Victorian Refugee Health Program was extended to the eastern region of Melbourne and continues to coordinate that program. She is on the executive of the Refugee Nurses of Australia, has authored two e-learning modules about refugee health nursing for the ANMF on the online learning program, and 6 months last year was the acting statewide facilitator of the Victorian Refugee Health Program, and she was endorsed as a refugee health nurse practitioner in 2014 and was proudly the first nurse practitioner in refugee health nursing in Australia. So please welcome Marilyn.
Thanks, Andy. Great to be here.
It's great to see you all, as I said this morning. I was thinking how I might start this, and the question was, what does advanced practice look like in refugee nursing? And I have to tell you that it is one thing. And what I'll talk about as we go through in my 20 minutes, which I've only got a timer because I could talk about this all day.
Any way that you choose to do it as a nurse practitioner,
and a very brief case study
about a family to perhaps show some of what I do. Okay, so the Victorian Refugee Health Nurse Program, which is actually now the Victorian Refugee Health Program, was established in Victoria in 2005. And this involved locating refugee nurses, and later with the change in funding to other disciplines, now bilingual workers, allied health, into 15 community health centres. So it's a primary care based, community health centre based model of practice. In 2009, the program expanded into the eastern region. Now I'm from the east of Melbourne, not the south east, not the south, the west, anywhere else. I'm from that east. If I've got nothing wrong in 10 years, I have never got that across to anybody, that we are not into the southeast. We are not into the north, the other east. You don't have to know that because you're not from Victoria, but it's actually really important to know that. And I am actually from the east of the region. So we have six local government areas, and the program is based at each. Each stands for Eastern Access Community Health, but corporately wise, we can't say that. We have to say each. And everyone's like, what does that stand for? You go, Eastern Access Community Health. But anyway, we're with each, which is in Ringwood, in the eastern part of Melbourne. A couple of years after I started, so I started that in that role, and we now have three part-time refugee health nurses in the east. A couple of years after this, there was a GP clinic located for refugees specifically at each, and that we now have two GPs focused entirely on refugees as part of our program. We're very pleased to have that program. It certainly made us able to offer a whole lot more services. They, however, only cover about 3.5 days a week, so there's a period of time where it's only the nurses currently getting the leads onto where I'm guiding with this role. We currently see between roughly 400 and 500 people a year. Last year we were different, I don't know if it's the same with anyone else, we saw over 600 people for refugee medical assessments. The model of care we established at each of the 15 programs is completely different, a little bit from each other, similar aims but different. We are more of a clinical model, but having said that, I would disagree that we are a clinical model. We also have community development involvement, our promotion involvement, many other key parts to that. But the model is such that the refugee health nurse became the first point of contact normally for all newly arrived refugees, and we work from that. We then see the person, the newly arrived person, we can interpret that, and then we refer out to GPs either internally, or we do have some community-based GPs as well. And so that's where that model came from. It was a little bit different. There are very similar programs in other numbers. It's exactly the same as that and some others as well. So I guess one thing is, because it developed that way, allowed nurses to function in an advanced practice role. So basically it was because of that. Because I'm not telling you this by the expert, because I know you all do this. If you go in and don't know what you're going to meet, what issues are going to be for the person, so you're taking all of the skills that you have, broad base of skills, to deal with lifespan and people from birth to whatever age. So that's where your advanced practice comes in to a lot. And you use all of those skills, your communication skills, your verbal, written skills, your advanced practice, assessment skills, physical, social, emotional assessment. You also are using critical thinking and all of those to create some work. So it is an advanced practice role, and you would all be doing that, I'm sure. So the need for the nurse practitioner role came because we could see that there were, you know, gaps hitting you in the face. Like you go and see a newly arrived family and they've run out of medicine, or someone's got a urinary tract infection, or the kid's coughing with a chest infection, and you go, I can't do anything about this, however, I'm going to send you off to the GP. Well, okay, why not have a think about whether you can at least manage part of that, care, at least for the immediate time before you can pass that person on to the relevant other health services. The other thing was that we also have a lot of drop-ins. So many people know to drop into each, and we encourage that. But people will drop in really sick, and if there's not a GP there, I will pick that up and work out what we're going to do with that person. So it's handy to be able to order pathology or send them to a chest x-ray before I then move them on to where they need to go. So those are the sorts of needs of why this role became pretty important in our area. And I also have the support of management, and I'm going to tell you that's the future. Thank you. So what is an earth practitioner? Am I going with time? Yeah.
So an earth practitioner is educated at master's level. We have to have a master's in earth practitioner, but don't let that put you off. I'm going to be very encouraging. If you have some postgraduate study, you want to be advanced recognition for learning, so that you may not have the entire amount of that. They work with key people, key health providers in regional, remote and metropolitan areas, which means nurse practitioners are right across Australia. There's a, that they perform advanced physical assessments, and again, it's within the scope of practice. Don't ask me to try and, do a particular sort of nerve conduction test or something like that. I'm only working within my scope of practice in terms of advanced practice. I can order diagnostic tests, refer to healthcare providers as a specialist. I can prescribe some medicine within my scope of practice, and I do a lot of operational support for that goal.
Okay, there are standards of
for nurse practitioners, so they build on the standards for registered nurses. So there's four standards of practice. One is an advanced using advanced diagnostic capabilities to make diagnosis for your patients. So there's about four statements that they explain what that standard number one is. One would be, for example, conduct a comprehensive, relevant, holistic health assessment. Hand out all of those that do that right now. And that those who conduct a comprehensive, relevant, and holistic health assessment. So you're already doing number one. Standard two is planning and
planning the care and engaging with others,
so it's referring and reporting and all those things related to that. In standard two is also the quality use of medicines, and that's part of your planning being able to prescribe. Standard three is prescribes, implements therapeutic interventions, including non-pharmacological as well as pharmacological. And the standard four focuses on evaluation, but also on the actual advocacy role that nurse practitioners play. They're really good advocates. They're very good liaison people. They're very good at evaluating people, evaluation, collaboration, advocating for their patients.
Oh my gosh, you can all do that.
Okay, so there you go. You probably already got doing most of that stuff. So nurse practitioners are also capable of managing a specific episode of care, and I mean from what you've got. Now, I don't do that, but there's the potential for doing that. But it's not, doesn't mean that you can't function as a nurse practitioner if you're part of a team of people. You can still have that role within the team. So it doesn't mean that you have to handle absolutely everything. You can handle small things, like you can handle a few small things, but it's usually the way that you work as the future health nurse is that you have it.
Okay, so each nurse practitioner has to specify when they endorse a scope of practice, and I have to tell you that was the hardest thing that I had to do. I had to work out exactly what it is that I wanted to do. We can give you this slide, it's we'll send it to you. So each nurse practitioner has a defined scope of practice, so for me, I had to tell them what I was going to do. So I was going to work with people with refugee and asylum seeking backgrounds, and also people of refugee-like backgrounds. Someone mentioned that this morning, that we deal with people with refugee-like backgrounds. I'm going to provide care in a primary healthcare setting, a community healthcare setting, and I'm going to cover all ages from birth right through. I'm located in the east of Melbourne, and it doesn't mean that you can't take that nurse practitioner role in other places, but for the endorsement, it's specifically Victoria. We have a state. We have formularies in Victoria where you have to prescribe from a particular formulary that exists, but that there's a primary healthcare formulary. So in Victoria, we have to specify which formulary we're going to be from, or it's not the same. So I needed to say that, and to obviously talk about the broader range of issues that we know about. Okay, this is my case study to demonstrate my scope.
I want to reiterate that the smoke's a point. So mine is a fairly, I would say, small smoke compared to the potential of the role for energy health in this house. Mine is relatively small.
But anyway, this is what we do. So Moo and Saw and Sun Tea, now these are made up originally, but that family, that is not that picture of that family, they're just the family that looked very early in the piece that I saw. So I've called them Moo, the mother, Saw, the dad, who's 36, and Kai, their son, who was four at the time of this case study, and they come from Burma. They both independently fled Burma. Let's call them Karen, but they're not from Chin State. They experienced the persecution that the Burmese soldiers now for doing on the Chin State families. And they fled to Malaysia, which is where they met. They had about 4 to 5 years of schooling each, and they worked in farming, which is a fairly typical story for the Chin. And they fled to Malaysia to escape that labour. They married and Kai was born in 2012. They were granted permanent visa and they settled in Australia. They actually had settled interstate. And then they moved to Melbourne to be with family, and that's when I saw them. So even though I predominantly see newly arrived people, we also see people who are close to settlement for whatever reason, and I'm sure you guys do as well as people seeking asylum.
So I did the refugee health assessment with an interpreter.
The assessment usually takes me a few hours. I'm very slow these days, so the interpreter about half an hour longer than I used to be, because I tend to talk more or they tell me more or whatever.
So from that, the key issues for Zor was that he had unstable diabetes, and I'll just put it out thing because I'm going to forget. He was previously diagnosed as type 2 diabetic, but then when he got to us, his beta cells were all over the place and cut and was 16 at the time that I took it. He had been addicted to codeine for 10 years and he'd stopped taking it prior to arrival, but this meant that he had very bad insomnia and headaches. He had quite major feelings of anger, particularly after Kai was diagnosed with autism, and so his anger probably very much associated with the addiction issues that he was trying to get over with was exacerbated by this. He had a motorbike accident in 2005, which meant that he had pain in his legs and couldn't walk for long distances. And both he and Kai had not been able to go to the dentist, not for the dentist's fault interstate, but just they hadn't got there and they both had pain. Moo also had diabetes. It was unresolved from gestational diabetes from the pregnancy with Kai. She had a really, really strong family history of diabetes, and her BSL was 18, so they both break up at the time with their diabetes. And she also unfortunately reported lots of changes in sensation in her fingers and toes, and she had a BMI of about 30. She actually had an excision of a meningioma, I can say that word, excision of meningioma interstate, and when she came back, she was due for a routine MRI, but she missed that appointment when she came, so that needed to be followed up. She thought she might like to have another child, but she lost interest in sex. In fact, there was quite a lot of stress between the couple, which was pretty evident when I first met them, and she was having a lot of trouble accepting her son and I, so she thought I'd get with him at 2 weeks and can't be with her house and her sex life. So she pulled out of bed at midnight after he finally went to sleep, and yeah, there were all those issues as well. She did not want to talk about what happened in Burma, only to say that she told the government all this and she wasn't going to talk to me about it, so obviously there was a lot of torture and trauma thrown in that, and then from an ongoing basis, and I still see her, it's probably still an unresolved issue for her. Kai's behaviour had first been noticed by his mother at about 2. So heavily noticed a lot of probably behaviours that they may not have noticed earlier, but the thing about his behaviour was he couldn't say the word mother to her, and that was really what on her by the time he was 2. She realised that there was something not right. So he actually had just been diagnosed with his autism when they arrived in Melbourne. Okay, so my role as a nurse practitioner, as a refugee health nurse, but in an advanced practice role, was to complete a safe, comprehensive assessment. During that time, I informed, educated, discussed the results with the family, and used strategies.
my role will be to link them with the GP, but I was very unsure about how the diabetes had been, so I was able to order a fasting glucose antidote and see if there was an idea about how the diabetes had been going. She also, what I didn't say was, had nitrates and protein in her urine and cystitis, so we sent my MSU off to see what was happening with that, and she was uncomfortable, and so I needed to do something about that straight away. So we had a look at the results as soon as they were available, and she did have a UTI, and so I would prescribe trimethoprim. I actually ordered that first, so the sensitivity came out of it, and that was fine to have that as an antibody. And we talked about fluids and neural. And then I referred on fairly urgently to the GP and to the diabetes educator, and also the other referrals that we all do as part of follow-up from an initial health assessment. So they went off to the GP and they came to our doctor at our clinic at each, and there was the optometrist because of the diabetes and Foundation House because of the torture and trauma background, diabetes educator, dental. Kai was linked in with, we didn't have any ice at that time, now do quite early intervention, podiatry, and the Kai was eventually also sent on to the Neural Children's Hospital, which does an outreach and link to our service once every 2 months, and we're very fortunate to have that.
Okay, that's the end of my case study.
Trying to demonstrate a very small scope of practice, which is something that I can put in place before then referring on. So I can deal with sort of some immediate issues before transferring our first intervention here. I have actually seen this family ongoingly and happy to conclude, apart from her perhaps trauma and the still concern about the relationship they have settled well at their own home. Highs now at social school and doing really well, and some it's been great to see, but it hasn't been about its issues in, as they progress through that. What you need to be a nurse practitioner, you need, well, please don't let this scare you, I just want you to have a little think about whether that's possible for you to do. They did say to me, if you've got a certificate at the moment in some area of postgraduate nursing, this is going to really help. So if you want to think about how to do that as a preliminary thing. But you would need to be currently registered as a Division 1 nurse. You need to demonstrate 5,000 hours of advanced clinical practice. That isn't an issue if you're doing emergency health nursing with a clinical employment. That was where my 5,000 hours came from. I did supervised practice with one of our first GP, as that first GP was my mentor. And so I did, I sat in on her clinics, and then she watched me do lots of things. I look after vitamin D, I treat parasitic infections, things used to say from the bodies, and just the glasses, so I throw that around all the time. So I can manage those, Helicobacter, chest infections, UTI, so that's the sort of basic thing that I can do in addition. You need to complete a master's course that's approved by the Secretary Board of Australia as a nurse, in nurse practitioner, and then you need to be endorsed by the as a nurse practitioner. And it's easy,
that's my presentation, so thank you. Thank you very much. So I'm just thinking of that second lager, working at an advanced practice level, and I think that's really the crux of the issue. Depending on which registration authority you come up against, there may be challenges in saying, well, what does advanced practice actually look like? And why do you consider that to be advanced? And that's why we were interested in starting to do the skills and competency framework, so that that becomes a ladder and a guide and a tool for everybody to use to be able to set yourself where you are on that framework, and then have a goal and a pathway to move yourself forward. Now, there's no doubt a lot of you are probably practicing at an advanced level in some areas. I know that what I'm really good at, and I know that I'm really lousy at, and I tend not to do those things I'm not really good at. I just think about the skill set that my own staff have, and like a lot of refugee health teams, they're coming with quite a diverse range of skills from nursing. So it's not something that new graduates come into, you know, everyone's coming from somewhere. That's something else for us to think of as a special group. Is there a new graduate pathway that should be established to bring those bring registered nurses in from graduation at the beginning and put them through? But you know, my staff have got expertise and postgraduate qualifications in mental health, in obstetrics, in child health, in sexual health, in ecology and palliative care. I thought we don't need those very often. But they all bring something different to the team. I think with Marilyn, what's also interesting is those few phrases that you said about having a mentor. How important was the mentor to you?
You actually do need a mentor. That's part of when you do the course. They ask you to nominate a mentor. You have one or more mentors. So that's where they came from. But it was vital.
Yeah.
Absolutely vital.
Yes.
And the difficulty for me was that there was no nurse practitioner in refugee health. And even though there were some primary health care, there's more now primary health care practitioners, there was not the expertise that I could pull up from a nursing point of view to act as my mentor. Whereas the people I was doing the course with, cardiac nurses, chronic disease, they had nurses that were nurse practitioners or certainly in advanced practice who could mentor them. So that was where my difficulty was, that luckily I had a great GP and who was very supportive of what I did and wrote my letter for the board
to
say that I had functioned that way.
Yeah. And I think if you look at the development of nurse practitioners, and I'm old enough to remember when that first came in, there was originally a lot of collegial support from our medical colleagues, including the AMA, who became crucial in the talks, and right at the last minute they pulled out. Right at the last minute, and really they've been very unsupportive since then. Now, most of us work in some sort of practice regimes in collaboration with doctors. And so if you are going down this pathway, we have to be very conscious about those relationships and the collegial relationships and understand the threats that you may pose and the toes that sometimes have to be walked on to get us to, you know, get us to that next level. Sometimes, and I've got colleagues, other nursing colleagues who are nurse practitioners, and for one colleague it actually meant leaving that workplace because the professional relationships have become so toxic that she couldn't actually function in that workplace. So she moved somewhere else and successfully became endorsed and is still working as a nurse practitioner. But it caused her some grief, I have to say, to have faced the realisation that she was not going to get that sort of support that she thought was there. And the worst thing she said was actually that lack of respect. From a health colleague to another. She thought at least she had their respect, but when the push came to shove, that wasn't there. So that's the bad news. The good news is, as you say, it's a good time to be doing it. Nurse practitioners are going from strength to strength. I think there is realisation from a whole lot of the health sector around that the model of care that we've got at the moment is too expensive, it's doctor-centred, and the outcomes actually haven't changed for many of our patients at all. And not just refugee patients, but on a whole lot of parameters. I mean, closing the gap, you know, just have a look at that. I mean, it's got to the point now where they've just released the closing the gap for this year, when actually, you know what, we're going to change the definitions because they just can't get any traction. So that's a political response. With different models of care coming, we need to be agile and we need to be ready to be able to put our case. But to do that, we have to describe what is advanced practice. So I'm just going to take you. Thanks, Marilyn. Are there any questions to Marilyn, by the way, before we move on? Yes.
I actually have two questions around one principle. I saw that your preference would be to use an on-site interpreter for your consultations. Is there a reason why you choose that over using telephone interpreters?
Feeling, I suppose, the best way to do it is if you pick up the nuances, you're able to control things that you can see the interpreter all the time. It's all the nuances. And then sometimes you have an interpreter there, and you know that they're not interpreting what you're saying. And even some people are there, like, you know, there's been, it's just having a control. But I don't mean control in a bad sense. I mean control as in you knowing what's happening in that situation. I also think that for the person, having another person there can speak the same language is usually reassuring. I think it's not always reassuring for reasons that we all know. So a fine interpreter is much more away, moved. Really useful. I would never not use a fine interpreter if I was just explaining this and I just had it.
And then you've got work to do, people. So, what is competency? The classic definition is it's a combination of your knowledge, your skills, and particularly your attitude. And that's actually a difficult concept. How do you measure attitude? How do you teach attitude? And how do you show attitude at an advanced level? You're probably familiar with this scale. This is the classic Benner's competence scale. So, you know, Benner's the nurse theorist, talking about the novice to expert. So if you have that beginning level with your reference knowledge acquired by work experience, right through to your expert, who's that experienced, really in-depth knowledge. And the way, and you've got your learners and your competent learners in between, and the way I always try and describe it to people is when I see my expert nurses in practice, they go A, G, M, P, Z. Because B, C, D, all those other things are embedded so deeply into their practice, they don't even know that they're doing it. But to get to G and to get to M, they've had to learn all those other things. Whereas where you see a new graduate learning, they go A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So they've got to go through the steps, basically, to get to the end. Right, we missed one. So knowledge means having a recognised knowledge base for practice. And that actually defines a profession. So if you look at what the definition of a difference between a professional and a trade is, for instance, professionals actually have a defined knowledge of a body of knowledge that their members actually define and contribute to, and that is actually governed by that group as well. So once nursing moved across into tertiary land, that's when other people, other professions started looking at us a bit more seriously and deciding that yes, probably we could be a professional rather than a trade, because that's what we were described before, that we were skilled tradespeople. And if you just, I'm just putting up here just some examples of the sort of knowledge base for practice it could be that all refugee health nurses should have. And then the depth of that knowledge may then define or differentiate between what is a beginning or novice and what is an expert nurse in refugee health nursing. Isn't she gorgeous, that girl? Yeah. Oh, that's my daughter. Far out. She's so lucky. She got a father's heart and a mother's brain. If it had been around the other way, she would have been in trouble, let me tell you. So Australian immigration law, you know, you have to know your visa categories. You have to know them. You have to speak visa in this part of nursing. You know, how does the Australian healthcare system work? Well, if you're going to refer people out there, you need to know public-private pathways. You need to know what gap payments mean, those sort of stuff. We all have to know how to use interpreters. You have to have a nursing science degree. You must know the immunisation schedules. You have to know about settlement programs. How do people get here? How do they get who? Who's IOM? You know, where do they go next? You have to have some good knowledge about psychological health theory, about grief, about torture and trauma, about resilience. You have to know what's happening around the world in regards to contemporary politics. You know, you need to keep an eye on the ABC and the website so you know what's happening next. You need to have knowledge about specific disease entities, like Marilyn was just referring to around strongyloides. That's a great word to throw around, isn't it? Schistosomiasis, that's such a good ring to it. You need to know about normal childhood development. So when you have a child in front of you that is actually not acting normally, or where parents have concerns, you need to be able to say, hello, we've got a problem here, or it's okay, mum. This is a child being three. Most kids who are three will do this, this, and this. And of course, we increasingly need to know about the health effects of ageing and disability. So that's just knowledge. So you can see, if we started extrapolating all that out, how much there is to know. As I say, but what actually will differentiate us between a novice and expert will be the depth of that knowledge and how we may define that. Attitude, culture, respect, advocacy, empathy, understanding, patience. God, you need a sense of humour, a lifelong learning approach, teamwork and collaboration. So they're sort of those airy-fairy things that, as I said, very hard to teach, rather hard to describe, but you know it when you see it. And more importantly, you know it when you don't see it. You know it when you get brushed off by the secretary at the doctors, at the private, you know, specialists. No, no, we don't bulk build. No, our doctors don't see refugees, really. You know it in regards to what does empathy look like? You know, it's about how you look at somebody, how you may touch somebody, the tone of your voice, the way you may seat somebody in the room. Just your whole body language can scream empathy or not. You know, that's the classic nurse thing of fold your arms like that, tap your foot, raise your eyebrow. Yes, you called the bell. Again. And then there's the skills. So, physical assessment, head to toe, BMI, skin integrity, clinical observation, psychoassessment, dental assessment, you know, oral health, pathology, what to order, interpretation of results, what are the catch-up immunisation schedules, and having really good communication skills, written, verbal, non-verbal, and cross-cultural. Okay, and that all has to be put into the context of the work that we do, And that's one of the known sort of contexts that they talk about with refugee health, is looking at the conflicts, the world events, flight, rescue and recovery, and so forth and so on. And so depending on where somebody is in their own context, you may change your approach to care depending on how you find them on the day. Okay, but there's also the enablers that we know about, and nurses are really good at this, because we know that unless you've got all this stuff, you're not going to have health, unless they've got somewhere to live, you know, with electricity that's going, the water that's running, unless they can learn some of the language, but be in a right physiological and psychological state to start learning English, where they may be getting some gainful employment, so that means they get their self-esteem back, particularly for the men who arrive, who want to again be the providers of their families. And nutrition, you know, stronger bodies, vitamin D deficiency, worms, all those sort of things, H. pylori, all impacts, and of course the whole thing around health literacy. What do I understand about health? I'll just give you an example. I looked after a family from Syria a few weeks ago, four children. Our eldest is severely disabled, and they'd already lost another child who also had a disability. So when we started talking about family planning, I said to the mother, were you planning on more children? She said, yes, the doctor in Syria said that if I had two disabled children, then all the rest of the children would be okay. I said, oh, did he really? You haven't got his number, have you? I'd just like to chat to him. So, you know, and she had a very fixed belief that because there were two disabled children, then all is well. It wasn't the time and place to say, let's talk about genetic theory, one in four chances, blah, blah, blah. So that's where you need to know about the health system, so we could get her off into genetic counselling, where someone had the space and expertise to actually take us through that. And in the meantime, there's a thing called condoms, and you guys are going to use them, so, okay. All right. So advanced nursing practice, the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Board actually do have a definition of it, and they're saying it's around regulating specialty practice, which is us, including people who can be licensed, endorsed or credentialed, validated and certified, and that actually formally regulating specialty groups for the purpose of registration did not reduce the risk to the public, which I think is rather interesting. So even though you may be highly specialised, it doesn't mean you're safe. But there was a lack of significant evidence that the regulation of specialty practice actually improved patient or client outcomes. So again, that's rather interesting. So it's rather counterintuitive. So we need to keep that in mind, that it just doesn't become an agreement fest, as they say, where we think we're doing the right thing, but that from an outcomes point of view, that actually doesn't change. Now, I always think back on the doctors' strike in New South Wales, when the orthopaedic surgeons walked out of all New South Wales public hospitals and took all their surgical mates with them, and most of the anaesthetists, and the death rate in New South Wales fell. It did. It actually fell because they went in there. They also recognise that organisations representing specialty nursing groups in Australia have developed processes for recognising specialty practice, and that provides a sufficient means of acknowledging specialist nursing practice in Australia and may be recognised by employers and the health industry at large. So again, it's actually up to us as a professional group to set the standards, describe what we do, and then we can put that out there. Not particularly for endorsement, doesn't matter who doesn't or who does endorse us, but for recognition. And for going forward, for you guys, if you're doing something like going down that nurse practitioner pathway, oh, that's too much. Okay, skill survey. So thank you to everybody who responded. We had about a 46% response rate, which in survey research is actually pretty damn good. Anything over 25%, give yourself a clap. So this is a little bit about us. Scarily, there's quite a large percentage of us who are over 55. I'm not going to tell you which category I'm in. And so again, that begs the question that we need to start looking at growing refugee nurses in the future. And so that's the things about actually, do we have establish a new graduate pathway, for instance. And look at that, there's only 5% of blokes. That's about it in nursing anyway, I have to say. The Australian government has actually started to recognise this. The Australian College of Nursing is looking at this. Most males in nursing go into three areas of nursing practice. What are they? Mental health? ED?
Surgery.
And ICU. Yeah, it's all that. I love all that action stuff. Yeah, okay. So the different roles, we were well represented. We've got a really nice mixture there of people in different roles, from early childhood nurses through to, you know, nurse managers, CNCs, CNS2s. These terms may be unfamiliar with some of you from different states, because we actually do have different professional roles in different states and different rates of pay, funnily enough. Come to New South Wales, we pay the best. And years of experience. Now, again, rather interesting. Majority of people there in the 6 to 9 years. And I think that would sort of coincide with what you were saying, Michelle. When did you start? At 2006?
The clinic. Yeah. In 2000 was our
Yeah. TBCNC. Yeah. So there's only two nurses in this survey who'd worked in the place more than 15 years. I suspect one of them is you. But yeah, so you can see there where the programs all started coming in. And we'll see that shift to the right, of course, as we stay longer in the work. Okay, most of the people who responded work in an urban setting. Some of those work in a refugee-specific setting, and some people working in urban and others. Now, that's a really scary slide. I just want to say to you what it is we start looking at... This is about the self-assessment of the skills competency. So people were asked to self-rate two things. How often did they use the skill, and actually how good were they? Where you look at the right-hand side of the graph, sorry, the left-hand side of the graph, probably no surprise that most nurses consider themselves expert at basic nursing observations. So blood pressure, pulse, temperature, blah, 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 okay. But as you move further along, then you start seeing there are real differences after a while in regards to how people rate themselves in regards to their level of competence. Things like referring to tier 3 HSS providers for complex patient care. So that's not a skill that everyone's very comfortable with. Doing a modified HEDS assessment, which is a psychological assessment that they use in youth health a lot. Managing diabetes. So these are now specific skills where people are going, I'm not very good at that. And that's often because there's other areas of nursing that take that up, like the diabetes nurse educator. So anyone with diabetes, off to the diabetes nurse educator. But you as refugee health nurses would see a lot of people on arrival with diabetes. A lot of people. Or diagnosed people who didn't actually know they had diabetes. Okay, so where we've looked at these circles, as I say, we've got the things now on under the yellow circle where everyone's feeling pretty cool about this, and we do it a lot, and we do it often, and it seems to be sort of part of the mainstay of refugee health nursing. But as I say, when we go across to the left, then they're the things that are becoming a bit more specialised. Are little things that maybe you need to be, depending on your model of care, will depend on actually whether you use this on a regular basis. So auscultating breath sounds, for instance, if you're doing a physical assessment on patients, does that include putting a pair of ears in and listening to someone's chest? So can I just get a bit of a straw poll? Hands up, anyone who does that, who uses a stethoscope and listens to someone's chest. Not many. Hands up everyone who takes the blood pressure. Yeah, right, okay. Okay, hands up who counts the respiratory rate. Yeah. What about measuring saturations? Doing a, finger set. Okay. So, interesting that we've got that you can do all that, but putting on a pair of ears and listening to someone's chest seems to be a step too far. I wonder why that is. What I say to my staff when they first start, I don't need you to diagnose, I just need you to know that that sounds different. So listen to everyone's chest, because after every 5 or 6 chests, you're going to hear something different. And that's when you come and get one of us, and we'll be able to start talking to you about what is different. What is different? And what do we need to do from here? Okay. Competency related to interpreter use. Look at this. God love yous. You're all fantastic. So whether it's you booking interpreter, using TIS, or using face-to-face, most of us consider ourselves to be absolutely expert, and that's because of frequency of use and the fact that they are absolutely, you know, in the middle of your practice without an interpreter. That's it, usually. That's the end of the consult. So there's probably no surprises to that. But looking at the levels of competency in mental health-related activities, a little bit different. We're good at referring. We know where the torture and trauma services are down the road, so off you go, and they'll deal with you. But I was concerned to hear, Canberra, you talking about there's an 8-month wait?
Yep. Yeah, for our counselling service currently, there is. They'll do an intake within the first 4 weeks or so and then try and triage the more urgent cases. But if you're not particularly urgent in that intake appointment, then there's an 8-month wait at companion.
Yeah, and that's a long time.
Yes,
that's a lot. And the some of the published literature about the mental health of, say, the Iraqi refugees who arrived in Sydney described that period from 6 months to 8 months where people fall off a cliff. So you really need to try to get to them earlier than that, because that's a really crucial time in resettlement. So that's a real worry, I have to say. Yeah. Using different psychological health assessment. So we started off using the K10 in Sydney, and it over-predicted everybody to the point where we should have been taking every second patient to the psychiatric emergency care centre in the hospital next door to us, because they reached this magic number. So that's why we've actually ditched it, because we don't think it's actually a good instrument to use. I mean, one of the questions is things like, you know, have you had trouble sleeping in the last week? And people say, of course, I was so excited and I was coming to Australia. I was on a plane. I'd never been on a plane. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so it's just like, yeah, they were very excited. They couldn't sleep. But it's nothing at all to do with the fact that they are suicidal. So, yeah, the context was actually wrong. So we have moved to the RHS 15. So if you're looking for a scale which we think is a much easier scale to use, particularly for people with poor health literacy, it's a way of opening doors to have that conversation. Again, we have a lot of budding dental assistants in the room. Well done. Everyone's getting pretty good at saying, open your mouth, say, close it, don't show me that. Isn't there some terrible teeth out there? Yeah. And one of the ways I always try, you know, when we've got students on placement that come in, first question I often say to them is, when's the last time your GP checked your teeth? And they all look at you dumbfounded and say, well, never. Never. Saying, right, so you want to know why we need to be in refugee health? Because when we send all these patients to GPs, who's actually going to check their oral health? No one. Yeah. So we can all refer to oral health services. And there's a spelling mistake. Competency in providing relevant health education. And again, there's a whole range of different things that we use. We're quite, you know, a lot of people are really expert in talking about drinking water, which is really good, but not so expert in other really important areas like swim safe. So Michelle and I had this conversation earlier this year, the number of refugees who have drowned around Australia. We've had all those drownings over summer. You know, people have drowned in rivers and... Yes. Yes. Yeah. And there's just been countless drownings. And you know, if you just wonder, where do they get that information from about swimming safe? Is that part of the stuff that you might want to give out? Is it something you want to talk to your settlement services about? Such a shame to bring people to Australia, get them safe and settled, and then they drown at the beach. The other things, as I say, SunSafe also is another interesting topic about keeping people safe in the sun. All right, how good are we at this? Most people consider themselves either to be competent or expert, and that's such a key role in our jobs around how to navigate health services. But as I say to people, I've been nursing over 40 years, I don't understand the health system, so these poor buggers have got no chance, really. It's just... competency in providing education on contacting emergency services, which is great, and providing health education of risk factors for chronic non-communicable diseases. And that's a real emerging health trend in refugee health, is that management of chronic diseases, hypertension, high cholesterol, high lipids, obesity in teenagers. We're really seeing about 15% of the teenagers that we're seeing in Sydney are obese, about 1% are morbidly obese. Looking at some of the food practices of parents with young children, particularly sugar in bottles, that sort of stuff. So where to from here? All right, we need to link our skills and our competencies further to the standards of practice. We need to further consult with the RNA members, which is you guys this afternoon. And we need to explore some of that formal education through ACN and other academic institutions. Okay, so what I need you to do now is, we've got the skills framework here again, and thank you for everybody who's already filled it out. So you told us how often you use it. You've told us whether you're good at it. Now we need you to get a piece of paper, and I need you to think and reflect and think about how important is it to you. How's important to your practice? Okay, Alan. This is going to be real interesting information, because what's important to my practice in my model of care may be totally different to what Michelle thinks, reflecting on her model of care. So after we do that individually, we are just going to get you to break up into groups, get up and have a bit of a stretch, and then I want you to argue amongst yourselves, and I need you as a group to come up with consensus, so a consensus decision around the top five. This is called the Delphi method. I don't know if you've done Delphi methods before. The Delphi methods are used quite a lot in health research and health organisations, because it's about getting an expert consensus statement about things. Okay? So you're our experts. We're going to get some consensus from you, and then we want you to bring that back. We're just going to see what are the five most important things that you have agreed or disagreed on. So
before you go, I have two requests. First of all, that everybody comes to the front so we can recruit a photo.
Oh, yes.
Secondly, that if you look on your name badges, you've actually got a number there, which is your group number. So groups 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are in on tables in that room. So it's butcher's paper and pen for you there. Group 6, I'm afraid you're in Sala. Little muffins and kitchen.
Around the border. Yeah. Okay, so we've got to have